We're waiting as Zach brings us a nice fireplace on the TV to set the mood. You'll need it. Strap in, because this is going to be a remarkable episode of the Movie Vault. Yes, we're going to watch the Adult Swim Yule Log.
Do I trust this?
I think you got to trust it.
Or do you think it's going
to be? It's going to be like Rick and Morty. Oh, ads, of course. That reminds me. Make sure you sign up for Hedman Angling Agency.
Have we forgotten to do that?
No, we haven't. Okay. We have not forgotten to do it. And if we have, you can always look in the description of the episodes. And there's, it's always there.
Dude, this dog needs to go upstairs. I smell his
blood. All right. Are we kicking the dog out before we start?
Yeah.
Dog, leave.
Yes, master.
Wish it was that easy. So, we are in a room.
In the middle of this?
We're, yeah. Hello? Well, it's YouTube. You didn't pay for premium.
He does. This is YouTube premium.
Oh, that's not fair.
No, he pays for YouTube TV. Pays, come on.
Yeah, but that's not the same as YouTube premium.
I know. Apparently, it's not.
So, today we sit in a dark room in a very nice home movie theater that we wish it was the Movie Vault actual studio, but it's not. We're just borrowing it for the night. We've recorded here before, actually. If you go back and listen to our Toy Story episode, we recorded then. Oh, my. Wow.
I gave him his treat, and he ran down here.
Wow.
Come here, buddy.
Come on,
Pace. Zach is... He's not always the best with dogs. But neither am I, so... Yeah, that's going to work.
I got to mark my territory. I just got to pee all over the
place. Yeah. Yeah, they'll appreciate that. All right, guys, you might have realized this, but this is the Movie Vault. I'm Ben.
Oh, and I'm Zach. Is this how we're actually starting it?
Yeah. Okay. You didn't know that?
No.
No, this is how we're starting it.
Well, let me start.
I want to gain a more authentic experience with the Movie Vault, where people feel like they're sitting in the room with us, because that's what podcasts are all about.
I knew I shouldn't have trusted this fireplace from Adult Swim.
Yeah, I know. They always mess stuff up.
You can't trust.
Well, I don't know if they messed up Rick and Morty, because I got rid of Hulu, so I can't watch it anymore.
Well, there's a voice actor change now.
Oh, yeah, that's got to have messed it up.
Yeah. No, this might be too distracting.
Zach is overstimulated by the Yule Log fire.
Yeah.
Well, let's just watch Sean Hannity. Yep, Ace, or Pace, I keep calling him Ace. Sorry, buddy.
I'll just do the Disney Plus one. Yeah, he'll learn. It's all right. Okay, well, what's the introduction? What do you got?
Well, I just wanted to really settle into this episode.
Oh, okay.
No, but seriously, today we are reviewing one of my all-time favorite movies, so I couldn't be more excited. The movie is called 8 and a Half. It was called that because the director, Federico Fellini, was being pressured to come up with a name. He had made 8 films up to this point, so he hadn't finished this one yet, so he decided to call it 8 and a Half, which is funny considering the plot of the movie. The story was by Federico Fellini and Ennio Fiolone.
Hmm.
Cinematography by Gianni Di Vincenzo. And there are some other Italian people involved in this movie. It was mainly released in Italy and France, but eventually it would come over to the U.S. via rentals and make $3.5 million. This movie is the story of a director suffering from writer's block, and he wants to make a science fiction film that is also autobiographical, but is having a hard time. His personal life starts to spill over into his movie making. He is bringing his mistress and his wife to the same spa in Italy, along with his boss and all the people in his movie. So essentially he is creating a sort of crisis to hopefully somehow provide a spark in his movie making. The movie constantly dances back and forth between flashbacks and or dreams. And sequences that we're not quite sure if they are real or not. This includes some childhood scenes
one of which scenes with his parents, one of which he and his friends, who are like appear to be 11 or 12, go to pay a prostitute to dance for them. And then he promptly gets in trouble with the cardinal at his school and punished. Whether or not this has affected him into his adult life is maybe up to interpretation, but it is certainly true that he has a complicated sex life and relationship life. He also dreams of having a harem of woman, which starts out as
of woman,
of woman.
Wait, you mean women?
Women. Yeah, I just
you said the same thing.
Okay, well, you're breaking my rhythm. Okay,
I'm sorry.
So it's kind of funny because he apparently has to push people into the upstairs if they have aged out of his harem, which is sad. And then this causes all of the women to riot against him, and his fantasy of having a harem of women quickly becomes maybe I can't pronounce this word, women.
Quickly becomes a nightmare. Is that what you're going to say?
It quickly becomes a nightmare. Louisa is bitter of how she is portrayed in the film. Louisa is his wife. And he has this character who is called the ideal woman. It's going to be a struggle.
Well, she ends up manifesting herself in like Clarita or what is her name?
Claudia,
yeah. So, yeah. I mean, she has a name eventually.
And she's the ideal woman in the movie. And Guido decides that he doesn't actually want to make this movie. He fantasizes that he shoots himself in the head, but then he doesn't, and he realizes he needs to accept life. He asks Louisa for assistance, and they walk hands, and the men and women who are around in this sci-fi scene, they walk around in the circle, and Guido and Louisa eventually join them. That is a very convoluted way of describing a very convoluted story. I left out plenty of stuff, but that's because you couldn't possibly really summarize all of the stuff in this movie. Essentially, the important aspect of it is that it centers around Guido, the director, and his relationship with his wife, his mistress, his boss, his producer, and then his relationship with himself, ultimately.
Yeah, I would say
as he is grappling with who he is and the decisions that he's made. In some ways, you could say it's a movie about having a midlife crisis, right? About reckoning with yourself in the middle of life.
Maybe.
On the choices that you've made.
Are midlife crises this destructive?
For some people, yes. Hmm. Now, it's stereotypical to have a midlife crisis. You really could have a crisis at end of life.
Yeah, those are
beginning
out.
Of life.
Infantry, or not infantry, you infancy
be,
crises.
You should probably be thankful if you are... If your crisis ends up being a good reflective moment that you grow from, you probably prefer to have it earlier in life.
But it's
if
more
it's
of a
destructive,
trial.
Then that's not really beneficial anytime.
Midlife crises are kind of cliche.
Yeah. So we're saying Fellini's cliche, end of podcast.
Well, no, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying this is my first Fellini movie. I'm very happy.
But what I love about
happy.
This movie.
Okay, it's back on now. Man, I think you missed my rant.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
I don't think we got it.
You want to redo your rant?
I can't redo it.
Oh, no.
Hopefully it picked it up on your mic.
Okay.
Probably didn't.
We can cut that out. But do you think that Fellini started the Me Too movement?
Possibly. But I don't think that was the main point of this
movie. No, it's
not
the main point. I'm saying for exposing...
Like, was it the first movie that suggested that there were... Like sleazy people in Hollywood?
I mean, maybe one of
the earlier. Or the film industry in general.
I mean, Hollywood's still in its first half century at this point, right? Or no, it's within its first century.
Yeah, but although I almost wonder what his goal is being that.
But he's not even in Hollywood as well, so I'm just thinking like.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's a reach. You just call me out if it's a reach.
I don't know that it's a reach, but I think maybe in a very... zoomed out sort of way, it could start getting people thinking, oh, what is this industry? Is it actually magical? This is what we've been fed. You know, because the 60s was a time that people were starting to question things.
Yeah.
Sexual revolution, which knowing Fellini's style, this movie maybe not as much, although there's definitely undercurrents of it, but I think sexuality was a huge part of what Fellini did in sort of a maybe somewhat controversial way. And I'm sure in the U.S. they may have censored some of his movies. Maybe not this one, but other movies that he made. City of Woman.
Sure, yeah.
Those, women and the idea, this harem idea and sexual politics were a huge part of Fellini's work. So, like, in that sense, getting people thinking about that, how that works out, how this sort of, like, drive that people have that if they, like, feed into it seems to, like, tear them apart and tear down the lives of other people around them as well. Which, you know, we would call sin, but they would just call, I don't know, a bad habit.
Urge.
Or an urge or something like that.
Yeah, biological and urge.
Yeah.
I mean, really, I mean, that's at the center of this film as well. Like, the thing that is keeping Guido from being honest is his sex life. It's the very thing that, it's him cheating on his wife. That's the big thing that he's hiding throughout this film. When the one girl comes up and, I forget his mistress's name, but when she kind of shows up to that outside pavilion area.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And Rosetta and his wife, Luisa, are both there. And he goes, yeah, I broke it off with her a while back. And they're like, they kind of call BS on him. And, you know, she comes up to them and you can just see, like, she is one of those people that maybe doesn't make a lot of decisions for herself. And she's really concerned with kind of how she looks. And she talks about, like, whenever I want something, I get it. You know, she says a line like that.
And she has a husband who she's cheating on, who's very much a pushover.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think Guido's like taking almost a little advantage of her.
For sure.
And she's also willing at the same time. So, I mean, that makes it a little easier for Guido's case. But at the same time, Luisa is being lied to this entire film. And she was invited out. Like, he invited her to come to this. And then, like, not only treats her that way by kind of leaving her behind and focusing on the movie for a little bit to get away from her, but he's also lying to her while she's there. And it's very obvious at the same time because these girls are coming up to him and have all access to him.
It's almost like he's tired of even hiding it. Like, maybe that's the reason he even invited Luis out in the first place, is he's like, this is too much energy that I'm expending. It all comes back to him and his selfishness. But you can tell he feels somewhat guilty because of all these flashbacks and the conversations with his parents who have died and the things that are happening. But he's still kind of acting out of his own self-interest at pretty much all points of the movie, maybe even the ending, where he and Luisa supposedly reunite in some effort to fix the film, which still ends up serving his interest. So yeah, that adds into whether that's even actually what's happening.
Yeah, that's a good point. And the flashbacks are a staple of this film just because, I mean, it kind of shows how he got to be where he is. Like, he was exposed to, like, sexual imagery at such a young age when that one woman was dancing for him. So then he started to see women as these kind of maybe objects that are for dancing or for pleasure or for just looking at, you know? And then down the line, like, I mean, 30 years or whatever, how many years later, he's imagining having a harem of all these women, and they have, you know, ranks within them. And the younger ones stay down, the older ones are just sent up, you know? It's like this horrible system that really objectifies women to its fullest extreme. And then his imagination also shows, like, it shows his flashback, like, that happened to him, and it shows his imagination, how far he's come from that, like, how much worse it's gotten. He's let this kind of bad habit go too far. And it also shows in his relationship with Luisa, like, these are the thoughts that he's having about women. This is the way that he thinks about women. Because he doesn't really have any relationship with many guys in this film. Like, he doesn't talk that much.
And the guys that he's around, the one guy, Meza Bota, has, like, a girlfriend who's, like, 50 years younger than him.
Yeah.
At which he kind of, I thought, at least on this viewing, that he kind of looked down upon that. Like, which is funny because who is he to be judging this guy?
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's also probably pride.
Well, I think he had also cheated on his wife, if I remember the story correctly, because he was like, how did your wife take it? Oh, she didn't take it too well. Yeah, no duh. She's not going to take it that well. Man, she took it really tough. Yeah, you dumped her for this girl who's like 20 years old. She's not going to take it tough.
Yeah, I mean, it is sad at the same time. Yeah. Like, this happens, but it's crazy because that just shows that Guido has compartmentalized that part of himself.
Yeah.
So that he doesn't see that as part of his self-image. And that's a very dangerous, I mean, that happens to all of us. Like, we have
that, definitely, yeah,
bad habits that we just ignore because we've done them so long to the point that we don't think of them as a part of ourselves. And then when we see other people do them, we look worse on them. As like, if we had not had that secret bad habit, we look worse on those people that have it because we feel guilt inside, and then we want to project that onto other people,
right,
by saying that
very true.
They are very wrong for doing that. That makes me feel better about myself. Because
or somehow what they're doing is worse than what I'm doing.
Sure, yeah, you're kind of setting the standard yourself right at that perfect line between you and other people, right? It could
right,
be a very
exactly,
thin line.
But yeah, it could be. It could seem really silly if you actually use some self-reflection too. Mm-hmm. I want to briefly touch back on my rant. I'm not going to go through the whole thing again, but I think it is a good point that this movie shows directors in a context where they don't have a God complex. They're not neurosurgeons. They're not perfect. Not to say that neurosurgeons are perfect either. That's funny. It's just the last context that I used God complex, I was talking about neurosurgeons. That is a generalization. There's a lot of very good neurosurgeons, and ultimately, if you're good at it and you're saving people's lives, we can forgive a few personality ticks. But
maybe. I mean, I'm not sure if I'm fully on board with that. But
well, to some degree. But
like, they can be horrible people as long as they're a great tool to society.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. No, I mean, there's only so we can't be that picky. There's only so many of them.
I guess
that's what they know. That they know that there's not that many. So
yeah.
So you can't be picky. They take advantage of that. But also, if I ever need neurosurgery, I'd want somebody who is good at it, and I'm gonna be knocked out. So who cares? Anyway, that's just a tangent for a different time. Yeah, the directors aren't perfect, and this movie does a good job of portraying that. If a director can be like kind of sleazy and lead people on, and they are using other people's money. They're using producers' money. I know in our society today, we usually look at big businesses and producers and stuff as like the bad guys, but and they can also be taken advantage of by a guy who has this reputation of being brilliant, according to everyone in the movie. So that's the point I was trying to make. It's sad that you can't hear me in my impassioned state that I was 20 minutes ago, and for some reason must not have been in the cards for that to release to the public, but I can still make the point.
When you dropped those 3 F-bombs, I was like, wow, you're going hard.
Yeah, yeah, you should have heard that.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think I agree with that, just like, yeah, I think Fellini's not only exposing, I mean, he's probably exposing his own bad habits as well. It seems so, like, the movie seems personal.
That's what I don't know. I think I've read that before, but I haven't seen like conclusive evidence from a quote or something that it actually is. Maybe I should just look that up real quick.
Yeah. But I mean, just the idea that keeping something from someone for so long and then bringing her to kind of see that side of yourself very closely while still lying to her face when it's so obvious that you're lying. I mean, that's like as bad as a bad habit can get. And your bad habits, like in this film, affect other people. And in this way, in this case, Guido's bad habit, his mortal sin almost, is making his wife miserable. And she comes up and declares the marriage over. And then after that, I mean, that's pretty much it. Now, I do question, though, the ending. Because he asks her at the end if he could get help, like, facing his own realities. He kind of, like, at the end, he realizes that he doesn't want to make a movie that's trying to help other people. He thought that trying to help other people might help himself. So it was almost like a selfish motive where he tries to help other people to help himself. But then he now wants to change from that to facing his own reality and the things that he has been hiding all this time. And just, I mean, this whole film is kind of one of his main story arcs is that he doesn't know how to make an honest film, and he expresses that. He expresses that. What is her name? Claudia. And even to Rosetta, or I forget her name. I think it's Rosetta. The friend of Louisa, the best friend of Louisa. That his struggle, why he became disinterested in the autobiographical film is because he was trying to be honest but failed to be honest. So then he kind of just spirals after that when he realizes that he can't make a film that's that honest, otherwise he'll have to face the things in his own life. And that's the danger of, you know, being in a position like that where your best work comes from being honest with yourself and with the things around you. And when I think of some of the greatest directors, like, you know, whatever, Tarantino, Scorsese, all these people are being extremely honest with their situations to the point where the things that are on the screen feel real because there's authenticity that comes with being honest. And when Guido in this film is trying to be honest by making a film that's sort of about himself, he fails to do that and realizes that he hits a wall and his creative, he's no longer creative. It's all gone. So then he realizes, like, oh, there must be something inauthentic about me that I have to face. That's my very calm, it's not a rant, explanation.
Yeah, and one thing to point out is that some directors reveal a lot about themselves in their vocabulary that they use based on the films that they decide to cast or the act.
Are you talking about Django Unchained?
Django Unchained, Pulp Fiction, and I'm just remembering a scene in Taxi Driver where Martin Scorsese plays a character in the back of a cab who says a certain word.
Which one does it start with?
I think you can guess. It's after the letter M.
Z?
Yeah, it's Z. No, but I don't know why I got to thinking about that, but I was like, it's so weird that Tarantino and Scorsese both did that.
Didn't Samuel Jackson give permission to
Quentin
Tarantino?
Well, yeah, of course he did.
He's the harborer of all of those words, right?
That is a... Yeah,
he's the king of that word.
He is. He's the final authority on it. But it is a very good point that there is authenticity that comes through, and it seems like that's what people who get really into cinema ultimately become connected to, is the fact that they can feel what another person is feeling. And then, of course, your own feelings come into the film. And you can dissect it from a technical perspective and say this was interesting or this was sound movie making. But I was reading Roger Ebert's 4-star review, which is perfect for, he judges out of 4. So perfect review from Roger here. And he points out that most people would say, it would make sense that Fellini's neorealist work, which was really in his early filmmaking days, so the movie La Strada that I referenced, that's going to be like a very neorealist movie. It seems like those should be the best. But it was actually the movies right after he abandoned that style of filmmaking. I wouldn't say abandoned, but he subverted it or changed, you know, took what he had learned from working in that style and kind of turned it into a new style and used surrealism, as we say. So like movies like La Dolce Vita is when he really started doing that. And then finally 8.5 might have been the highest point. Ebert also seems to point to Juliet of the Spirits and then Amarachord also. But the fact that he changed the direction that he was going in, added something new, is the authentic part of the filmmaking experience. He didn't just keep doing what he worked under Roberto Rossellini, who's famous for Rome Open City and was a famous neorealist, like one of maybe the guys who made neorealism so popular in the first place. Instead of just like being the protege of Roberto Rossellini for his whole career, he decided to do something different. And that is the magic of filmmaking, how you can learn from somebody else, but then you can work within this box and work within these rules, but then you buck everything and you change it,
mm-hmm.
and you become a revolutionary, but you're also constantly reflecting upon yourself. And that's coming out in the movies. And here we are again saying how amazing directors are. And really, maybe a lot of these directors are actually not that good of people. And maybe they would be kind of miserable to work with.
Well, this is a tangent of yours once you're done.
But the results...
Save it.
The results show for themselves. 4-star reviews from Roger Ebert, so...
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, maybe it's one of those things where Roger Ebert goes back and makes it a 4 after he realizes that...
That's a good point.
...too low.
He wasn't perfect either.
Yeah. But... This is a tangent. Do you think sometimes films go down in history because of the changes that they make, the new genre that they create, or a new style or camera angle system, or something, you know, it's newness. But then the most, not even just legendary, but like, I don't know, things that define cinema aren't just new. when I think of like just new without having like authenticity, I think of like the Avatar movie, right?
No, that's a good point.
Where
that's
it's like it's this groundbreaking CGI type of stuff.
It's more like we're rushing out something because it's a technological advancement, is what you're saying.
Exactly. Not even just technological, just like it could be something different, you know? But there are a lot of movies out there that are famous because they made something different. This film kind of pushes that neo-surrealism pretty far. So I think that's part of the change. But this film also has authenticity. I think that's what adds to it so much and why it makes it a legendary film and why Ebert made it a 4, maybe after writing it lower. But just the fact that this is something that about like 40% of men in America go through. Where like unfaithfulness to their wife. I'm being like completely honest right now. Like this is not an uncommon thing for someone to have a wife and then just be in lies in that relationship, for there to be lies between you and your wife. I don't have a wife. I don't really know what that's like, but it sounds like it would be really self-destructive if things came to a head at some point. And obviously divorces are so easy now that you can just, you know, go to the mall and get a divorce. But this is like real life, and that makes it more authentic. It's not just an Avatar film. It's not just a feature that you can now use in films moving forward, you know? I even think like the Angry Birds movie, stuff like that. Like, let's make movies about an app on an iPad. Like, that's pretty groundbreaking, but at the same time, it's not authentic.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. And it is interesting to the point that the subject matter is true to life, so the realism aspect still comes through. And I don't know. I feel like in some ways our podcast, we're very meta here at the Movie Vault, has become, we try to give advice to young filmmakers because all we're doing is watching the greats now, and observing, making these observations about, well, what did they do that made people think that they were great filmmakers? And it seems like we're onto something here with, it seems intuitive, but it's probably harder to pull off than it seems. And that's just like, think about what's going on in your life. What's truly, you might think your life is boring. That's the thing. Somebody like Fellini, he did have an interesting life, but he also, you know, you get into these mundane tasks and you're like, oh, you know, I'm cheating on my wife. No big deal. Like this mundanity. Not exactly. But, and I don't know whether Fellini was cheating on his wife or not, but he was probably around people who were, if he wasn't doing it himself. And he started to think more deeply into what does that mean? How does that affect? What is the root? I know people throwing around a Freud in terms, just in general, in terms of Fellini's style and maybe in its relation to sexuality. And obviously Freud probably had an overall fairly negative, I shouldn't even say fairly, negative influence on how people view sexuality. But nonetheless, you have to acknowledge that we live in a world that most people subconsciously think of themselves and identify in a way that is somewhat can be attributed to Freud's thought. So probably for worse, but
yeah,
that's the world we live in. So it reading, like kind of diving into that and then, in all these different ways. And it's funny, Pauline Kael, who's really famous film critic as well, she didn't like this movie because she called it a structural disaster, which I think is hilarious because in the long run, that's actually what people like the most about this movie is it's almost like I feel better about myself because she didn't get it. She watched it and she was like, oh, the structure's bad. Well, no, it's not. It's just different. It's like, it's not something that you've seen before. And we can't really, you know, always blame film critics, but it is fun when they get it wrong because they're kind of fool of themselves, just like directors are, the constant push and pull between the director and the film critic. So there's all these undercurrents of all these things that are happening in modern society, and now we can look back on them and say, you know, make some guesses as to what was influencing them, and maybe it wasn't even consciously influencing them. But you know, what do you think of those observations, Zach?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think, I mean, obviously the whole point of the film was to subvert something. That's what I was saying. Like, there's a newness to this film that makes it go far. I still think that, not even the, I don't think the neo-surrealism for me is the best part. I think the best part is just, like, he has to face lies. That's a common problem that we all have. No matter how out there this film seems, there's still something that grounds it at the same time. It's like we were just talking about outlets, Ben, where you have to have that one, the third prong to kind of ground you, or sometimes when you pull out the plug, it's going to shock you.
Very true. Very true.
That loosely relates.
And you're right. You could make a movie that's just surreal for no reason. Actually, there's a movie that comes to mind. I don't think you've seen this movie, Zach. Synecdoche, New York.
Nope.
And a lot of people love it because it is very surreal and kind of meta and all of that. But I found it, and I'm sure it was trying to ground itself in some way, but I found it to be overall a little bit full of itself and just sort of enamored with its own plot. And it fell into more of a nihilist take on things, which ultimately leaves you feeling empty. Who would have guessed? But so it's a movie that you're like, sure, it's cool structure, but the authenticity doesn't seem to be completely there.
Yeah.
So, and the same guy wrote a movie that I really love, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
That's the same guy?
He wrote it, but he did not direct that movie. So I think this is also the thing. Different people have different skill sets. Sometimes when you take away a different mind who's helping to direct the movie, you get, you know, different direction on things. A little less hope.
But yeah. Which, I mean, we should review that movie someday. Have we reviewed that movie? Eternal Sunshine?
Oh, yeah, we have.
Oh, yeah.
We should review it. We did. That's we did. Hilarious. I don't remember what we said about it, though.
That's hilarious. I mean, it was probably 2 years ago.
Yeah, at least. At least 2 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, that's another grounded film. I mean, there's always that. Yeah, but yeah, I mean, we always rave. I'm gonna find out ways so that I can implement Inland Empire into every single podcast episode that we do from now on.
I think you cannot understate how much Zach and I view Inland Empire as the greatest achievement in cinema history, and I don't think enough people realize that it is.
It's
because
just like
not enough people have watched it,
and I realize how can we go further.
Yeah,
is this the end of the line?
It's true.
Do we have a higher... I mean, it's not like...
But watching a movie like 8.5 makes me realize that Inland Empire was, you know, 50, 60 years in the making.
I agree. Like, Inland Empire is like... Lynch saw all of these films and was like, there needs to be a conclusive tentpole film to conclude all of cinema.
Because I want to say, Fellini did a great job of merging the worlds of dreams and reality, like we talked about, but it's nothing like Lynch.
Oh yeah, I mean we're gonna rave. I mean we're on a Lynch. We've been on a Lynch wave for
one day.
A couple
months
now.
We're gonna look back and be like, man, we really like David Lynch a lot. But maybe that will never end. That's kind of what I'm hoping.
I hope not. I hope that one day I can have all 4K box sets of David Lynch on my shelf, so I wake up every morning and be like, ah. Eraserhead. I was just listening, actually, this is a tangent, on the Big Picture from The Ringer this morning, and they were talking about Eraserhead, and that, like, if they all got together and watched Eraserhead, then they could solve all of the world's problems.
Do you think we could?
No.
We already tried that.
Yeah.
And it didn't work.
I also learned that it only costs 2-something billion to solve world hunger each year.
I know, it's not a lot.
I know.
Well, people throw out numbers like that, but is it really true?
I mean, I don't know how you measure that. Like,
well, because like, what are the logistics of that?
Well, they measure the like your stomach growling. They measure the reverberations of that around the earth.
No, I want world hunger to end, but I just when people say it only costs this much, like, how are they getting to that number? Like, it's great to say that.
They probably do, you know, I don't know, surveys.
Like, and also, hunger is a continual thing. So, like,
yeah.
If you just make one payment of $2
billion. Well, no, it's annually, 2-something.
Annually. Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming they're, like, factoring in that they're, like, trying to make it, you know, you make an initial investment, and then it's supposed to be, like, the crops keep growing, and then
well,
it's,
I also
like,
wonder,
less.
Like, yeah, I mean, infrastructure is a big part of it. I also wonder if, like, what the quality of the food would have to be for a figure like that.
In my class, we were talking about errors in history. As much as I kind of don't like this class a lot, there was some interesting points in this one. Errors in history where like companies were able to take advantage of the fact that they could get a lot of workers and work them for very cheap, and they could figure out like exactly how much to pay them, and they just for them to survive and keep working. Mm. That was like fascinating. I was like, yeah, that's a good point. I mean, you notice though that those periods of history don't last forever. So you don't necessarily need to put in a socialist government. Like, well, obviously those are people taking advantage of other people. That's bad. But hopefully that's not all. Hopefully that's the exception to the norm, is what I'm saying.
Yeah,
but
it's people. I mean,
and it's people. So people are always going to take advantage of people no matter what. Yeah. So that's the sad part.
Just like Guido.
Just like Guido. That's what we're learning about, human flaws. Mm-hmm. I mean, Guido was taking advantage of, like, everyone in this movie. And potentially there were some people taking advantage of Guido as well, in his name and prestige.
Question, does Guido learn a lesson?
Ugh, that is a great question. I don't know whether he learns it. He definitely identifies problems. Mm-hmm. But I also, the question that comes to my mind is he facing these because he really truly wants to change, or is he just exhausted from the problems that his decisions cause?
No, because I think he was exhausted when he started to kind of fall out, no longer having interest with the film he was making. I think that was his exhaustion. I think when he finally meets his ideal woman and his ideal woman rejects him because she thinks that his protagonist himself is inauthentic or can't love because he's so fake, I think that rejection kind of showed that, like, he needed to have some change, and he kind of realizes that. So when he, at the end, goes up to Louisa and says, like, I need you to kind of walk with me in this. Like, I need your help. Like, I think what Carla, the ideal woman, says is that he can't do it without the people in his life. And I think he realizes that it's not the ideal woman that he needs. It's Louisa. So then he grabs Louisa, and they go in the circle at the end. But what is that? Like, what does that mean? Does that mean he learned, like, he's going to treat his wife well? Is he going to try to get back with her? Or I have no idea. That's where I landed, right?
Right.
So that's ambiguity, your favorite.
Yeah, I do like it. I do like it a lot. Because it just, the conversation never ends. And to me, that is invaluable about a movie. A movie that is maybe not bad, but a little disappointing as a movie that you can finish talking about, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe there truly isn't a movie you can finish talking about, you know what I mean. Like, the directions that people go, I don't want to be talking about, you know, whether the film serviced the fans enough and all this stuff that's unrelated to the actual movie.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be talking about the theme, the plot, what it all means.
Yeah.
And I think 8.5 is a great example of that. Obviously, I have it as my fourth ranked film, so technically I have it ranked higher than Inland Empire, even though I'm giving Inland Empire all this praise. But I think it was truly an impactful movie in terms of getting me into movies as well, because I had mentioned this to you. I don't know at what point. It was my senior year, end of high school. I think it was right as COVID was starting. I kind of decided I'm going to get really into movies. I don't know. Maybe I always knew I wanted to, and it was just like I was old enough and decided it was time. And of course, like, I watched Taxi Driver, Goodfellas, all the pretty much every single Tarantino movie that summer. But the one movie that I watched that summer that maybe was a little different than all the other ones was this movie. And I watched it because I found out that somehow I had got access to Canopy, probably through Worthington Library. I don't know why I'm saying the specific library, but if you live in Worthington, you can get access to Canopy through Worthington Library. So there you go.
Yeah.
And I watched it. I'm sure I watched it over more than one viewing, but I just remembered, like, it was nothing like I'd ever seen. And I don't think you can go back and read my original Letterboxd review. It's really long, and it probably, like, completely misses the point so many times. But it just is, like, it's kind of fun to read it. For me, because it's like looking at where I was, and just like there was such a, like, mesmerized, awe-inspired moment. And watching it this time, I still felt that way. Like, I still felt like, wow, this is like cool. This is something that I wouldn't be able to make, and I'm still trying to figure out. So even though I can say, like, I've watched a lot more foreign movies, I've watched a lot more movies on Canopy, I'll still never get there in terms of, like, and nobody ever will. Because there's no real, like, defined limit of what being a film expert is, or, you know, it is subjective. So there's some mystery in, like, trying to determine what movie is good and has value and what movie doesn't.
Yeah. And it's honestly, it portrays life. That life is a movie, and you can slip in and out of this movie, right? Sometimes we are in reality, sometimes we're not. Because a big chunk of our lives are in our head. And
our thoughts, yeah.
And I think Fellini portrays that really well, just that this guy's experience, Guido, what he's experiencing from his very soul is not just what's happening in the physical world, but it's also what he's thinking about and imagining and his feelings and all of his inner thoughts and deepest, darkest secrets. And that is all of us, right? Life is not just what's in front of us, but it's also what's inside of us. There's nothing special inside of us, I would say that. But there's also, we have a mind. We have ways to interpret the world around us, empirical data to analyze. And what we need is to realize that. I was trying to figure out a conclusion before I ended the soliloquy.
That's the problem. All of our thoughts are off the dome, so you can tell. Like sometimes I'll start a thought and I'll finish a thought and I'll be like, wait, how did I transition from that one thought to that other thought?
Well,
but that's kind of like what watching 8.5 is like. So that's the miracle.
Yes. So highly recommend. I mean, I think I gave it 4.5 stars on Letterboxd,
which is good. That's a good rating for me.
That's a great rating, in fact. That's an excellent, amazing, fantastic
rating. For me, it's still 5 stars. Might be a little sentimentality in there, but still a fantastic movie. Love it.
Yeah.
I was glad that I was not disappointed, because when you say something's in your top 4 for so long and you've only watched it one time, there's some risk there.
It's like meeting your heroes.
Yeah, it's true.
I can't say.
There were a lot of parts of this movie that I did not remember, which is not shocking because like I said, it was nearly 4 years ago that I watched it the first time. Yeah. So,
did you ever think we'd review it?
I think I had.
Did you think it'd take this long?
Yeah, I don't know. It never really came up.
Oh.
I probably said over the years at present, oh, we should review 8.5 sometime. But it just, the moment was never right until now.
Yep. And this is the second film in our, we need to structure our story arcs a little bit more.
Yeah. This is the second, I think we film. Said, called this the 60s one, but more accurately, this might be like 1960s European art house.
Yeah.
That's a I think way. Would be a better way to describe it. As we're doing two, basically we picked a film that was kind of either right at the start of the French New Wave. Yeah, I think it was basically right at the start of the French New Wave.
Yeah, 60.
And then we picked an Italian surrealist, neorealist movie. And then we picked a movie that was sort of at the end of the French New Wave. So it does encapsulate a lot of like important aspects of European film history.
It would be nice to strike, like maybe we could have done a French film in here.
Yeah, we could have done a French. One. So maybe 8.5 is like kind of a happy accident here.
Yeah.
Whatever,
I'm content. It's fine.
Yeah. Eventually our 3-part series are going to be really tight.
Or they will
be really, really loose and ambiguous. Yeah. Like we'll have this title and they'll be like, what? It's like soda. I said that because there's a sign that says soda over there. Like what? How could they? And there's like a movie and there's like one scene where they show like a soda can. And that's like, that's how we're tying it all together.
I would love to do that. Or like blinking more than 57 times is shown on screen.
Yeah, that's our theme for this, the next 3 movies.
Or there are 3 separate women that lick their lips in this film.
Yeah. Yeah, that could be a good one too.
Or 27 people died on set collectively in these films.
That would be the film Rust.
Yep.
No, not exactly. There was only one, but that's still sad.
And we'll do an Alec Baldwin tribute.
So, this movie won, before we, you know, close off, this movie won Best Foreign Language Film in the Academy Awards. So this is one of the ones he won.
Yep.
Probably should have won Best Picture. I don't know what won that year, but I'm sure it was better than whatever it was. And he won a bunch of other stuff, so you can read through that. Let's do some movie highlights. I don't have very much right now.
You've been watching Twin Peaks still?
Yeah, I've been watching some Twin Peaks, but I have a lot of clinicals to finish up, so that's been eating up a lot of my time, unfortunately. But
for class, I watched this film called Sorry to Bother You. It's all right.
It's all right.
Yeah, that's all I'll say.
Wait, is that on Netflix?
I don't know.
If it's a movie, I think I could. I'll look it up later. I did want to point out, since I've been watching Twin Peaks: The Return. It's very interesting, very intriguing. We'll be excited to watch it more. But I was like, I've been listening to some music lately, because when I study, I have time to listen to music. So two albums that have really
you're trying to add music segments
really
now.
I'm really stretching the limits of what we're doing here. Maybe two or three albums. Well, one album I've been really obsessed with is Alice in Chains' Unplugged. There's something about the grunge era bands playing their songs acoustically that's just, like, incredible. I've also been kind of revisiting some of the Nirvana MTV Unplugged album, although I'd already played that through a bunch. But the Alice in Chains specifically, I've just been loving their Unplugged. Just so many songs. Nutshell, Heaven Beside You, No Excuses. It's an incredible, really, really sad story their lead singer dealt with, like many of the grunge era bands, unfortunately, dealt with drug addiction for over a decade before tragically and miserably dying, but somehow was able to pull himself together for this kind of magical performance. Then I also have been listening to some Jeff Buckley compilation albums and enjoying his... realized that he had done some covers of some Smith songs and covers of some Bob Dylan songs that I didn't know about or hadn't, like, looked into previously. And so I guess I'm kind of in my tragic 90s, you know, tragic bands where people died tragically.
Did Jeff Buckley die?
Yeah.
No,
he didn't die of drug addiction. He died in a swimming accident.
What?
He was swimming open water in the Mississippi River and drowned after a boat drove by and he got caught in the wake.
Wow.
Yeah, it was crazy.
How old was he?
He was like in his late 20s.
What?
Yeah.
And I'm assuming
so that's why he only
after.
That's why he only had one album. No, he was I mean, he was relatively popular. But, I mean, his cover of Hallelujah, I think, exploded long after. Like,
there was.
Yeah. Because that's his, like, really, really famous song. I think he's one of those guys who's kind of steadily grown in popularity. But so really, really sad, but at the same time, can still appreciate the music. So thanks for letting me go on that tangent while I was slacking on watching.
Oh, yeah,
movies.
You didn't really give me an option. But
yeah, I didn't really.
I watched the film A Beautiful Boy.
Nice.
Steve Carell and Timothy Chalamet.
Oh, I saw you reviewed this.
Yeah, it was really good. I gave it 4 stars. I thought it was awesome. It tackles drug addiction. That's what it's about. A boy getting on drugs, and his father's trying to help him any way he can. I mean, about halfway through the film, his father's like, you know, as much as I do, I can't help him. I can do everything I want, but sometimes when I help him, it actually hurts him. So, sad. Because, I mean, everybody probably knows someone who's affected by drugs or on drugs. You know, they know that, to some degree, they're making that choice, and it's a horrible decision. And to some degree, the drugs are making the choice for them. So...
that's one of those very, very difficult things to deal with.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's a great way to end the
yeah, podcast. It's a little notes on drug addiction to end the movie vault. So we'll just close it.
I mean,
here.
We've tackled a lot of things in the last few weeks. Just some heavy topics.
I think...
mental health with Sunset Boulevard, just giving all of our advice.
Yeah, all of our unmerited, unwarranted, or like... nobody really asked for it, but we're willing to give it.
Yeah.
We're willing to give it.
Yeah.
All right. Shall we close the vault?
Sure. Go ahead.
Dun, dun. We really need to increase our budget.